This really is the full motivation for my having written the memoir. I did and do want people to know what the process is like. Not only what the process is like, but what the feelings are that don't really make you think of psychoanalysis as any way of changing your life. We're just living and hoping that things will change without really taking account of the fact that we could be living better lives and in a better way. And I began to think, you know, of the ways of the world and the wickedness in it. And there are so many things that we do to keep us going, as they say. Me and my aphrodisiac, and I think other people doing other things just to divert them from the misery or the unhappiness that they feel. And I don't know how often that's looked at or discussed. So I hope the book does open that up a little bit.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Beverly Kolsky. And I'll tell you a little story about how Beverly and I first met. Some time ago, I received a book in the mail, and the title of the book was On and Off the Couch, Memoir of a Psychoanalyst. Needless to say, I was intrigued by the title and read the book and was very moved by it. Beverly is a psychotherapist, psychoanalyst. She trained in London and the States, and she describes in this book her personal struggles, which she makes very clear were quite considerable, and the nature of her analytic experiences and how essential it was in helping her get perspective, distance, and choice about the life she wanted to lead. And very little is spared. And she says that she did this because she wants to let the non-clinical population at large know about this thing called psychoanalysis and how, even faced with what she called chronic misery, it's something that can really redeem oneself and allow one to choose a life that's deeply satisfying. She has been in private practice. She's now mostly retired. She now lives in the Northern Adirondacks. She has published in two publications, one called Mind Conciliums and the other Voices, Art and Science of Psychotherapy. And I found both the book and getting to meet her and discuss the book with her to be it's very satisfying to see one get so much benefit from this work and then to be able to extend it to others, which she describes in the book as well, some clinical vignettes, I think it's something important to bring to others' attention. So here's my conversation with Beverly Kolsky. Beverly, welcome to the podcast. So good to have you here. Beverly, we as a field are learning how to communicate our work to the larger non-clinical community. A very important task for us. We've ignored it for far too long. And we seem to be doing it in any one of three ways. Most importantly, we are ourselves involved, as the saying goes, off the couch in the community. And it is people meeting us and hearing how we discuss our work, hearing how we relate to each other. And I would underline, because I've heard this so often, the respect with which we refer to patients. People have commonly noted how moved they are by hearing analysts discuss patients with such respect, never laughing, and how they note that that's different than other clinicians. So that's one way we let the community know of our work. The second way is by writing up case descriptions, obviously well disguised, but case descriptions that are without jargon and that actually engage in common sense as part of explaining the non-common sense of the way the dynamic mind works. And not everybody can do it, of course. It takes a special skill, but when they accomplish it and the reader gets a sense of there's something unique and powerful about this way of understanding the dynamic mind, they are left with a long-standing impression. I'm reminded when I was growing up, Robert Lindner had written the 50-minute hour, which to this day made an impression on me. And the third way that we are discovering more and more how we can let the outside world know of our work is what we're here to discuss today, which is your memoir of your two psychoanalyses. And we will be hearing from more authors in the podcast going forward. People are doing this more and more, and it leaves a powerful impression on the reader. And you bring two special qualities to your memoir. The first is that you are yourself a clinician. You trained to become a psychoanalyst. So that gives you an additional perspective on the work you went through. And the other thing you describe, there are times that I found sections of it difficult. The struggles you describe in very great detail are very moving. They're troubling. You are really very transparent about how difficult sometimes were for you. One doesn't know, of course, in a memoir what isn't put in, but what is put in is powerful, and your willingness to make yourself as transparent as you did in service of showing how this analytic work can reach those painful parts of one's inner life is I don't know what the word is what is powerful, is meaningful, is important. That's it. It's important. I want to start by reading two brief quotes that give sort of an overview of the difficulties you struggled with and the beginning of the remedy that you found. And then I'm going to ask you to walk us through these phases of your life, and then we will hit on some of the highlights from the book. You write, "To be recognized by something outside of myself, to be seen by another as I would like to be seen, was an aphrodisiac, a drug that elated me and then disappointed me. It was only after the party was over, the laughter had worn off, the money had run out, when the other woman suddenly appeared and slapped my face, when these things happened again and again, that I realized that I had found nothing. But this epiphany was long in coming. Before that, the cycle was repeated over and over. Periodically, I became exhausted, limp, tarnished, and each time, more profoundly lost." We could spend a great deal of time on that. You then write later in the book, "Why was I where I was and how did I get there? I looked at the wreck my life had become and held onto my job for dear life. It was mother's milk to me, and a new world was opening, an inner world that had been sealed off. This was true nourishment. I learned to thrive on it. It saved my life, so I entered a new universe, the inner world. It eclipsed the old one, the outer world, and it was like that for a very, very long time. I was in a 9-year analysis in England. It took place for the most part 3 times a week, but it also went up to 4 times and towards the end slid down to 2. It seemed like 1 year. Time disappears when one is in analysis. The outer world loses its landmarks like times and years and events. We note them, but we rush back to that inner world where our energy lies because it is there where we learn to make sense of the outer world. One's committed to this process. It is like having a seductive and secret lover who beckons to his other room to come home after a hard day's work. Come, he says, we will figure this out. My analyst had become the most important, the most positive presence in my life. Beverly, the floor is yours. It's a hard act to follow, yeah?
Yes. I suppose I should begin this by saying that I always had a sense of longing for something, as long as I can remember anyway. And marrying the right man and a good man didn't dispel that. It was also the 60s, our marriage, and everyone was searching for something. And so we were kind of very trendy, and we were searching too. And that kind of dovetailed very nicely into my sense of longing. I'll begin. This searching and found us on the island of Hydra in Greece. We were young, we were solvent, and we had time, and my husband had a career by then where he could write from abroad and send his work home and be paid for it. So we left for Europe for an indefinite period of time and started our search in London with transcendental meditation. London was great at that time, and we practiced with a disciple of Maharishi. And then my husband wanted to find Leonard Cohen, the singer-songwriter whom I had never even heard of, but that was fine with me. He liked his poetry and he wanted to meet him. So that's how we ended on Hydra. And it was fine until the day that he had been away for the weekend, and he came back and said that he had been with another woman and he felt terrible about it. But he knew then that this wasn't it either, my marriage, that something I had failed, and I knew our marriage was over. A few weeks after that, I met a French painter on the island and fell in love, and I stayed with him for the next 5 years, living back and forth between France and Greece and traveling through Europe when he had an exhibition.
Let me read from the book. Let me read from the book, because you describe very powerfully that moment after your husband's confession. And you write as follows. As we entered the taverna one bright winter's day, soon after my husband's confession, I felt a burning gaze directed at me and turned to see where it was coming from. In the corner of the room sat a man staring at me as if he had never seen such a vision before. His gaze was severe and relentless, as though I were looking into a mirror lit by the sun. Sitting alone at the table as he was when I first saw him, I sensed danger. He was small in stature, blonde-haired, and with the lined and rugged face of an older man, but the body of a slender, muscular young one. The contrast fascinated me. He looked worn but forceful, sensitive but tough, and very French, with his tightly knit wiry body and casually styled attire. He oozed sensuality. I tried to look away, but I could not. He was fixing me with his eyes, possessing me, claiming me as though he had been waiting for me to walk through that door. It sounds like the beginning of a movie, and in a way it was. Because in the book you describe your years together, and well, why don't you pick up from there?
Yes, it was the gaze that riveted me. And it was, you know, such a feeling of being recognized that I think I had been longing for. And it alone acted as an aphrodisiac, really. It made me feel so good and so right. I realized, so yeah, I will say that I attached myself to this man. My marriage had failed. I had no idea of my future. I didn't know where to go or what to do. And this was an answer. So I lived his life, and it acted
That's quite
as,
a sentence.
Pardon?
I lived his life. That's quite a sentence. I lived his life.
Yes, I followed what he needed to do. He would occasionally sell a painting. He liked to live on an island where there was so much light. He loved to drink, and eventually I learned that he loved other women as well. I knew from the beginning that this was not a rescue. He didn't like children and would never want one. He didn't know about marriage. That was always left as a question mark. But while I was with him, none of this seemed to matter. The sensations were so intense. And if it wasn't the sensation of just sheer physicality with him, it was new countries and new food and new people and so much beauty. And that was the other diversion. I remember early on, we moved to Athens for the winter and lived underneath the Acropolis. And when he had to go out to sell paintings to some in some rich part of Athens, I would cross the road and go up to the Acropolis and just walk around. And there, that sense of despair would grip me. And I'd be waiting for him to come back so that it would leave me. And I could, you know, be alive again, basically. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Clinicians listening to even just this little piece of your story will have all kinds of imaginings and questions. The power of the sensation-seeking that you were drawn to. And like you said, the real-life issues of marriage and children, which you imply were important to you but didn't exist for him, suggests that the sensation focus was in place of an affective attunement of more object-related intimacy. But we will get to that, as you have described it, emerging in your analysis. In fact, to go to that, you write the following. This is after you left him. You write, "So I left the home that we had so lovingly made on the island of Simi, just as I had left my ex-husband. I threw a second dead fish back into the sea. I was, if not consciously, moving on. I was moving elsewhere. This time, I landed on an analyst's couch in Little Venice, a section of London, near Regent's Canal. I was paying for someone to recognize me, and she did." And that's the beginning of, I don't know about the next part of your life, but a different part of your life. Anything you want to add to that?
Yes, I realized after living 4 years in England, my money ran out on that island for the second time. The first time I had gone back to America and worked for 6 months, and I realized I couldn't be there anymore. I loved Europe, and it was home to me. So I came back with my money, and we lived another year and a half together on another island called Simi. But then that money ran out, and the French painters said, "Oh, you'll love England." And so I went there. They were also, they had a change in government at the time. And so they wanted to employ social workers who were American trained because we were trained in giving therapy. So I, after a few months, I found work there. It was really difficult to land in a foreign country, knowing one person and finding people who were actually so kind to me. And it was the kindness that really kept me going through this period, through all of England, actually, but certainly through this period of trying to find work and a bed to sleep in. That was the other problem. This house was a kind of seedy, rundown house full of bed sitting rooms. And until one became available, I was invited to share a bed with one of the others. So these were total strangers, and they were wonderful. So I worked giving services in the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea. And my job was to go around and see what the clients needed. And they certainly, if they needed therapy, they certainly didn't want therapy. They wanted either for me to listen to their stories of how they had come down in life, a lot of them, or to just, you know, help them get over a hangover. And so I, after a while, I moved on to a nonprofit agency who gave therapy to anyone who wanted it. There were only about four or five of us, and the others were all in their own psychoanalysis training to be psychoanalysts. I had tried to give therapy to the clients who were coming there, and I realized very quickly I didn't know what I was doing. I was really in over my head. And I was also in over my head living in a foreign country, away from my family. What was I doing there? And so I entered psychoanalysis. I remember the first session saying to my analyst, "I don't want to change. I just want to understand what therapy is about, what I will be giving to other people." That seemed only right to me. And it still seems only right to me. But it was a rationalization, really, for my really sense of weakness at that point and surrender to it. Hmm.
We will get to some of your quite nuanced writings on the transformation that you were involved with in your analysis. But the other question that would be on anyone's mind listening to this story is, who are you? Where did you come from? What were your parents like? And we have a section about you're lying on the floor of the woods looking for your father's face above me in the clouds. But why don't you fill us in, because your father had a dramatic and tragic end.
Yeah. My father died when I was four. He was 32 years old. He had had rheumatic fever as a child, and he died of rheumatic heart disease. The last year of his life, he was very ill. but not before that. My parents, my mother knew when she married him that he was ill. They both knew, but they never talked about it, and certainly not to us. I had a sense of something because he had very blue lips, and I always wondered about that as a little girl. My brother was 3 years older than I when all of this happened. We were very close, the three of us. And I think my father, in retrospect, of course, was stockpiling his love for us as well as his money. He was working very hard to build up a business that his father had started for him. My grandfather, his father, came to the country where we grew up, really, as a house painter, and then he taught himself how to build houses, and then he bought land and built houses. And this was to be a conglomerate for his two sons of the selling of wallpaper and paint. Anyway, it was before the war, and after my father died, fortunately, we never had to worry very much about money. It was there. So I think just as he was taking care of us financially, he was taking care of us emotionally. We played together, and the three of us. My mother would be somewhere in the house busying herself. And he really, after he left, it was as though there was this comfortable space between my brother and myself that was the presence of my father. We carried it very carefully, again, never discussed it, never talked about him, but we carried it very carefully between us, and it was a lovely thing to have. My first analysis was overshadowed by my father's death and my relationships, of course, and the connection between the two. And I feel that it was so successful that I have my father inside me now, much the way that I would imagine daughters growing up with their fathers have them inside themselves. And that's been a great gift. It's been wonderful.
I can only imagine. Let me read what you wrote along the way of that internalization. Again, you wrote, apart from these instances of lying on the floor of the woods looking for my father's face above me, I was unaware of missing anything, even him. But I suppose I developed a sense of longing that silently grew within me, becoming a part of me. I longed for something, someone who could make me feel right again, lighthearted, adorable, and loved. No words were ever put to these feelings, so I was forced to live them and relive them, these feelings that were given no name.
When I was a little girl, I'd take my blanket and go across the street to the woods where there was a field, and I would lay down on my blanket and look up at the clouds and think that I saw his face and his body cavorting around. And when I thought I had seen him and had enough of that, I'd go back home to my mother. So, yes, I'm sure that that time was the template for my longing for something.
It is a real challenge to describe the nature of change that takes place in a psychoanalytic process. For me, one of the pleasures of your book is how you are able to capture those feelings in words. And let me just read a couple of paragraphs where you bring that to light. You write, "But I was changing. Just as one cannot feel one's feet growing until the old pair of shoes no longer fits and causes pain, So does the process of analysis develop so slowly that one does not realize its growth until the old behavior does not work anymore. It no longer engrosses us. We scramble to find another way. This in and of itself is a difficult and sometimes painful process. But when we do arrive in a new place, we tire of what we had known, and like an old toy, it is dropped in the corner of a room. At times it is picked up again, but quickly dismissed as boring or stupid, as in, what am I doing this for? One moves away from it until it disappears altogether. One moves on. You go on to say, sometimes behavior becomes so much a part of ourselves that we think it is normal. If we think about it at all, we accept how we feel as a way of life. It is the only way of feeling that we know, so how can we think of it as odd or wrong? How can we know that certain behaviors are destructive if we have nothing to measure them by? We are still eating and working and socializing. We are still raising children, going to the PTA, going out with the girls for coffee. So what is wrong? And then you write, what became surreal was my past life. How could I have done the things I did? Things that killed my spirit, and some that nearly killed my soul, not to mention my body. And the whole time that all this was occurring, I thought I was doing nothing wrong. It's such a beautiful way to capture that transition from, you know, the saying is water to a fish. That's what the fish knows. Or in jargon, it's changing from something being syntonic to being something dystonic. Is there anything, I'm hesitant to ask you to say more about it since you say it so beautifully, but is there anything more you want to say about it?
Well, I think that this really is the full motivation for my having written the memoir. I did and do want people to know what the process is like, not only what the process is like, but what the feelings are that don't really make you think of psychoanalysis as any way of changing your life. We're just living and hoping that things will change without really taking account of the fact that we could be living better lives and in a better way. And I began to think, you know, of the ways of the world and the wickedness in it. And there are so many things that we do to keep us going, as they say. Me and my aphrodisiac, and I think other people doing other things just to divert them from the misery or the unhappiness that they feel. And I don't know how often that's looked at or discussed. So I hope the book does open that up a little bit.
Indeed. Let's mention your mother. You write about her. Now, your brother, as you say, was 3 years older, and you write about your mother. She loved him, your brother, and she loved boys. Girls, she would always say, were difficult. And so I was, by the time I reached my teens in the 1950s. Until then, I had been her good girl, her handmaiden, her caretaker, her companion, and her friend. I'd been a part of her, carried inside of her as if I were another bodily organ. I had been fused with her. This symbiotic state was a creative solution to not having her at all. You know, I'm inclined when I see a sentence or a few sentences that capture something as succinctly as that, I light on it. This symbiotic state was a creative solution to not having her at all. That you are honoring your defensive character as creative is so vital. It's so easily misunderstood, disparaged. The terrible word resistance is terrible because it doesn't highlight that however we are managing our internal and hence external lives, we are all doing the best we can do. It's our creative solution to the challenges that are internal to us. And this was your creative solution to not having her at all. It's a challenge for children. It's a challenge for daughters. It's a challenge for sons. The literature is fairly clear that people who work with children, that when the mother is emotionally, perhaps physically, but also emotionally unavailable, the nature of the struggle is different for sons and daughters. You are able to engage in a symbiotic state, and then you worked your way out of it through the medium of your analyst and your analyses. A boy has a different kind of problem when they find themselves in a symbiotic state with their mother, depending to a large extent on if and how the father is playing a role in this. But I just wanted to highlight the simplicity and gracefulness of that sentence. This symbiotic state was a creative solution to not having her at all. But that's what I thought. Why don't you share your thoughts about that?
Yes, I what you say about the difference between sons and daughters dealing with a trauma is interesting, because my brother dealt with this very differently from the way I did, certainly. He became a parent to me, and I think in that way he was able to keep his father with him longer, but I don't know that. I just know that he became the most loving and gentlest and kindest of parents. He was a saving grace for me. But soon after my father's death, my mother took to her bed, and for us as children, she seemed to stay there a very long time. And the only way that I could be close to her was by being good. And I know that at night, every night at 3 a.m, exactly that time, I would find my way into her bedroom and lie next to her body. And the symbiotic state, this is such a metaphor for it, because I would lie next to her and feel her body through the membrane of her nylon nightgown. And that was how I could have her in those days. That and going to school, because my brother would take me there, I had to go. I would have preferred to stay home because I was so worried about her. And I worried in school and couldn't wait to get back to her. So a lot of my childhood was spent alone without other playmates, but caring for her.
The number of times where you have mentioned and the book mentions the word kindness, one can't miss that, how central kindness is. And as I turned to the next paragraph to read, I hadn't noticed, but the title of this chapter is called On Kindness. And you bring it forward as another piece of how your analysis was of so much help to you in the face of what you call your misery. Let me read that that section. You write, "In my relationships, I was making the same mistakes over and over again. As soon as one inappropriate relationship ended, I would begin another. This was my way of distracting myself from feeling the hurt and pain and loneliness. Bloodied and exhausted though I was, I could not see my way out of this pattern. In fact, there was something so engaging about being miserable that I must not have wanted to leave that state, much as I knew consciously that I had to. Misery loves company. Often means the need for more misery to keep the rest of the misery company, until an entire brigade of misery is assembled and we become so depressed that the only place to take that brigade, short of suicide, is to the psychiatric ward of a hospital, where one needs to do nothing anymore. Everything is taken care of, no worries. Luckily, understanding dawned on me before that had to happen. Maybe part of it was because I did register my analyst's behavior through the throes of my own. Sometimes I could feel her flinch at my distress. She hurt for me. She felt for me. I could feel that. and I began to hurt for myself. Such an important observation. She hurt for me. She felt for me. I could feel that, and I began to hurt for myself. I guess going back to what we were saying, that's one way that the fish becomes aware of water when the person encounters that. There's a whole other way to register one's experience, and it's not syntonically through misery, but it's through, oh, maybe I don't have to do that. Maybe there's another way. And sometimes an analyst's comment or tone can alert one to the other possibilities. Anything you want to add to that?
It's difficult for me because it's difficult to talk about, actually, because the kindness meant so very much to me, much more than any theory or any interpretation. And I know that's not in the literature, but it certainly exists in the treatment room, or doesn't. I was fortunate to have it exist. And it was through that I realized I'm really a danger to myself. You know, I keep doing these things and it's not getting me anywhere. Of course, I kept doing those things because I was afraid of what would be next, what the future would be. I had no idea. And I think this is true for anyone in analysis. Change is so terrifying because we don't know what it's going to be. At least we know what we have. It eventually caused me to really step back and look at what I was doing. And then she was there for me as well, in the various incarnations that one goes through in analysis. One as a child, one as an adult, one, you know, screaming one minute, laughing the next. We're so free when we're in analysis. It's almost like the freedom of infancy. You know, you just are. And she was there through it all and held these various incarnations together for me so that I could eventually form my own mosaic. And that was me, my life. Yeah.
I'm going to ask you to read a bit about that in a moment, but I don't want to let your comment simply get past, your comment about the kindness in the office and how vital that is. This is obviously a very complicated subject, and perhaps it's not a complicated subject, that having had the opportunity to speak to colleagues from around the world, both on tape for the podcasts and also having conversations with them offline, just between us, how often people will make reference to various kindnesses that they received from their analyst.
Ah.
And whatever the theoretical definition of their meeting was, they are moved by their kindnesses. Now, this is not to jump to say that this is simply a cure through kindness, despite Freud's phrase of it's a cure through love. I don't want to make light of it and the whole slippery slope of everything goes as long as you're kind. I'm not saying anything of the kind. I'm simply saying that kindness is a piece of this work. And if for nothing else, to help people see how difficult it is for them to receive kindness, which opens up a whole interpretive area of their challenges to receive kindness. So I don't want to dwell on it, but I don't want to have it be ignored either, your comment about your analyst kindness, which I guess is a bridge to my asking you to read on page 82 just about that very point.
Yes, the gifts of kindness that I was given by the British, and especially the kindness given to me from my analyst, changed me forever. I'd like to think that I brought them back to America with me. I'd like to think that I passed them on to my patients and to those around me. I'd like to think that they are that cat in the room, that graces it with her beauty. But the truth is that I do not think about them any more than I think about breathing. Anyway, it feels like that.
And that's really a beautiful segue, because that has become syntonic for you now, the kindness. It doesn't require thinking. That's your new water. You're in a new pond, and you're not surrounded by self-destructiveness or provocative eroticism, but instead kindness. And what a lovely place to have moved to. You have a couple of clinical examples that, which I guess includes a reference to kindness. Why don't you start us off and tell us a little bit about Sarah, and then read, we're on page 158.
Yes. Sarah was came to me at age 15. Her mother, I spoke with her mother first, as I do when I see children. Sarah wouldn't leave her bed. She wouldn't go to school. She wouldn't go anywhere. She just wouldn't leave. And her mother said that she had been asking for therapy, but her mother didn't think it was necessary. In the family was an older brother who had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. So the mother had run the rounds of institutions and hospitals and medications, and she was fed up with this, and she didn't have patience for Sarah. So she left her with me, and that's how we worked for a number of years. Sarah was a willing and non-willing. She had wanted to come, but when she actually arrived there, she didn't look like she wanted to be there at all. And in fact, after the first session, that was about the only thing that we agreed on, was that she hadn't wanted to come. But after that, she never missed a session, and I think we were in for it for a number of years, 6 years, 5 years. And she wouldn't talk. She was very silent. She couldn't talk. It's not that she wouldn't. She couldn't. And I use a technique called empathic attunement. It's Heinz Kohut. To get into the shoes of my patients. And so with Sarah being so silent, I had to go into her silence. And here's how it worked with Sarah. She'd arrive at my office looking obviously anxious. She could not speak. Through this outward appearance of anxiety, I worked to gain entry into her inner world. "Sarah," I'd say, "you are anxious today." This comment was greeted by a slight nod. With her seated across from me on the couch, I leaned back in my chair and allowed her silence to enter my mind and to fill it. I tried to imagine what she, in her detachment from me, was feeling. I groped my way around in the darkness, metaphorical arms extended in front of me like a blind man's, until I could see a shadowy door in front of me. Slowly, gently, as though with outstretched index finger, I would push it slightly open until I could understand more of what was happening for her. If she appeared to be unresponsive to what I thought she was experiencing, I'd move on to try another door. And when I felt that I might be onto something and tested that feeling by asking her if this was true, I entered the chamber stealthily, on tiptoes, while adjusting to the darkness. A feeling like fear or anger might confront me. These feelings frequently took the form of a bodily feeling, such as a constriction in my throat, or my stomach twisting into knots, or a weight on my chest. Then, like a mother teaching her child to speak, I'd put a name to what was being experienced in that moment. Sarah could then tell me what the name meant to her, leading us further into her inner world until we arrived at the experience that she had had to repress. I wrote about Sarah because I felt impelled to write a little bit about sexual abuse, because I feel that we're so accustomed to looking at the big, in quotes, sexual abuses like incest and rape and all those devastating, horrible things, that we don't often pay enough attention to the smaller abuses. I learned when I was training that, children, having sexual play together, that's not so terrible. But this was devastating for Sarah. We learned that she had been abused by a boy 3 years older, the son of her babysitter, and that the feelings in her chest were his knees on her as he threw her to the ground, and so it goes. A bigger pattern, we later found out, and was that in her relationships after that, they were always started out as good, just as hers and his had started like two children playing. And then it was followed by betrayal. And I didn't learn till years later that she came into treatment, the trigger for it was her best friend had betrayed her. And so, yeah, we were able to identify her problems and relationships back to that trauma.
It's a wonderful ending to your book where you describe your journey, as we've pointed out, at times quite difficult and at times quite enchanting and powerful and positive. And then you bring it to others. And you share not just your kindness, but you're also your technical skill, which make a formidable combination, as you indicated. Let me read a closing paragraph, and then I will ask you to do the same for another. You write, "There is no cause and effect result in psychoanalysis or in psychoanalytic therapy. Unlike medicine, where a pill is given that is known to have a desired result, psychoanalysis works in far less linear ways. The movement towards change is a back and forth one. Put another way, psychoanalysis can be compared to climbing a mountain by spiraling upwards around it, arriving at a higher point with each step. The same signpost is being passed, call it the symptom, but it is seen from a slightly different perspective as the climb goes higher, until the signpost is out of sight because the top of the mountain has been reached." Again, your grasp of the process and your ability to poetically share it with the reader is to be a bit crude, is worth the price of the book, folks. It's really worthwhile. Let me invite you to read the final paragraph.
"Like life, psychoanalysis is a continuing process. It doesn't stop once we cease experiencing that flutter of expectation that occurs every time we ring the analyst doorbell. Issues crop up, new feelings arise. But we are able to more quickly cut to the center of the matter, whatever it is, because we better understand ourselves and our emotions. We better understand what those feelings are telling us, and how to make use of them in an environment we have been able to choose for ourselves." And so it goes.
Indeed, so it goes. Beverly, you and I had an email exchange about your writing of the book, and I wanted to read it to close out our conversation. You write, "I have always been passionate about wanting people who are not in the field to understand what it is that we do, how it works, and what the benefits are. My motivation for writing the book was simply that, and the only way I could think of doing that was to tell what my experiences had been in simple layman's terms. Well, for this reader, you have certainly succeeded. It's a vibrant, vital, and really touchingly written book, both about your life and your work on and off the couch, as it were. So thank you, Beverly, and it's been a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you so much, Harvey. It's been a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.